Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 92 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is getting towards the end of the year 2024. Can't believe it. Well, we're like in the third quarter of the year, but we're getting towards the fall season here. I'm seeing the smallest tinge of fall because we had one cool day here and all the trees got confused. But yeah, we're having a good day over here. Well, good week, I guess you can say, over here in Southeast Louisiana. And how's things going in, what part of Portland is that? Portland is like
South
Oregon.
No, it's kind of like the middle of, it's kind of the north of Oregon, but I'm in the kind of south of Portland proper.
Yeah. So, Carmen Leskovansky, my co-host, how are things going this week?
Oh, just fine.
Yep. Have some new things going on in the yard?
Oh, yeah. We've got a new apprentice just moved in. So we're getting all settled with that. Mm-hmm. And I've unlocked the cat door to the laundry room that I had them blocked out of for like the last 2 years. And so now I'm joined by Rufus, my co-host. He realized how to get through the door. It's been undone for like a week and they haven't used it.
Mm-hmm.
But he finally figured it out.
So now that they know, it's going to be
very, very exciting things happening here.
Yeah, that's going to be their obsession, is they're going to go in and out of that door for like the next couple weeks until you leave.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we have a really fun topic today. I guess you can also include it as part of our science series, our kind of more of a deeper dive into the horticulture side of things. And since we have our very own horticulture specialist on our show, we can actually pick Carmen's brains about particular subjects about plants so that we can get a deeper understanding about how things work in our bonsai. So today's episode is going to be about genetics and how they affect our trees. So I don't want to go too far because this is something that Carmen has a lot of notes on, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but basically saying stuff like, what's the difference between a cloned specimen tree and a tree that's like an individual seed, and how do genetics affect all that? And what are the factors of growth, habits, and patterns on bonsai? Basically, is what we're looking to do. And there's probably more to it, and I might be going on a different tangent than what Carmen has jotted down, but that's the exciting part, right?
Oh, yeah.
So,
I mean, I'll say I had the very basic plant genetics course. I'm not by any means a specialist in this area, but I can at least give you the brief rundown of how things basically work.
But anyway, before we get too far, we need to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over at Patreon.com/ Little Things for Bonsai People. Head on over there and become a Bonsai Best Bud and hang out in the Discord and talk bonsai with these people all day long. We have so many patrons now that I read out the list at the end of each episode. So if you want to hear your names shouted out every week, it's at the end of these episodes now. But we do have a featured Best Bud, and our featured Best Bud this week is Boyd Snellgrove. So Boyd is the president and longtime charter member of the Acadiana Parishes, our new Iberia bonsai club here in Louisiana.
Ooh.
So thank you, Boyd, for supporting and being a good bonsai friend. See him pretty
often.
That
sounds so mystical, like Acadia. And what was the other part of Acadia? Acadia.
Yeah, it's Acadiana Parishes. And it's New Iberia is the name of the
town. New Iberia, wow.
New Iberia is not very new. It's kind of like New Orleans. It's actually a pretty old town. But it's a nice little brick and mortar kind of feel in town, like old railroad station kind of area. A lot of the places down in Louisiana are like that. Anyway, thanks for supporting at that level. And of course, we have our main show sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools, and the specimen best buds always get a shout at the beginning, Unryu Inn and Bill Butler of Bill's Bayou. And I can't go much further without telling you guys about our editor, Matt O'Donnell. Makes us sound smart, cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. You can go over to mattodonnell.com. That's mattodonnell.com. And you can not fill out a contact form. I say that and I need to take it out of my notes. But you can go email Matt from or message him from his website, and he can start your very own podcast show with you. Or if you're interested in doing audio engineering projects with him as well, he's capable of doing that. He's a set basis living in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all around awesome guy. It's in the script. I say it every single time. And Matt has an ongoing podcast show called Matt O'Donnell Wants to Know, which is on episode. Matt, you're going to make fun of me for this. I saw it on your Instagram, bud. So
I saw it too, but I don't know what number it is.
Yeah, I know he's up to date. Matt.
Excellent.
O'Donnell Wants to Know. He's on it. Oh, yeah. Okay. Episode 18 so far. His most recent episode features Nathan Rocky, a photographer and creative. He's a portrait. He does a lot of portrait photography, video work, art direction, fine musicianship. So a lot of people on his show, if you're interested in that type of content, there's a lot of people on his show that he features like that along those lines. So anyway, back to our science episode, I guess you can say, is going to be about genetics in bonsai and how they affect the growth habits of our trees. And so I'll kind of just springboard from my understanding, because I told Carmen this the other day, that I was just kind of like, I was doing the dishes. I was just hanging out. And all of a sudden, this is a habit of mine. I'll just start daydreaming about certain things about bonsai. I mean, you got to be a special person to not stop thinking about bonsai, like have a career in bonsai, literally have trees in my yard. So I never truly step away from it. And then I'm just doing the dishes and mundanely just daydreaming about the genetics of trees and just like kind of brainstorming.
What a weirdo.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
no, I'm just kidding.
My mind is flooded with a lot of useless information, it feels like sometimes. But yeah, I was just kind of like pondering about like if I love a certain tree for its growth habit, and this is always the thing. It's an ongoing joke with this. There's bald cypresses in my collection that the dimension of the species is that all of my bald cypresses are genetically different. They have to be, because all of my trees are collected from the wild. It's very, very uncommon, I've found, for there to be a cultivar of bald cypresses that are distributed as bonsai. Mm-hmm. I'm yet to hear about one. I know there's a couple of cultivars, but whenever you have a cultivar of a species, and you can correct me if I'm wrong at any point, Carmen, because you obviously know better. Cultivar is just a clone of a particular characteristic.
Right. Yeah. So cultivar stands for cultivated variety. So it is some kind of, so it's the same species. So it's still a bald cypress, but because it had some kind of mutation that people liked, it was then cloned. So say it has like a super small leaf or something. So they liked that small leaf, they cloned it. Now it's in the nursery trade. And so it's a cultivated variety of bald cypress. So still the same species, but with different characteristics.
Yeah.
And you see this probably mostly in perennials. And I mean, you see it in trees too. But if you walk through a nursery and you see all these different colors of petunias or impatiens or pansies or, you know, kind of whatever flowers you see every day, in your garden, most of those are, you know, cultivated varieties.
Yeah. And I think that is a important thing to mention, is that cultivars are very important to the bonsai world, I guess you could say, in a way. Mm-hmm. Because when we break down like even the most popular species, the Shimpaku, mm-hmm. has a short list of like cultivars that are within that species of mountain juniper from Japan,
right,
that make up the vast majority of what's grafted onto certain junipers to improve their foliage.
Right. Yep. So Shimpaku's got Itoagawa and Kishu are the two most common, but I believe there's more.
There's like
probably a bajillion. Right. But yeah, so these are all, and even I've seen even within Itoagawa, sometimes you get, you know, a strain that has even smaller foliage. So it's like Itoagawa miniature. So it's really interesting how even some of these cultivars can kind of change over time.
It's like to even simplify it even more for like, if you're a beginner, you're a true beginner and you're like walking into this episode and you're just like cultivars, genetics and plants, grafting just sounds really odd. Just know that even the simplest tree, like your first bonsai, the Mr. Miyagi green mound juniper that everybody loves, is a cultivar of Chinese juniper. Mm-hmm. And even that green mound, it's a Procummins variety. It's a variety of a variety of like a cultivar. So the Procummins Nana is the small, is the dwarf version of the Procummins.
Mm-hmm.
So it's even more specified. So you wouldn't even think it. So you pick up that bonsai material from wherever you might get it from. Like a reputable sailor bonsai or a nursery where you see that ideal little juniper. And I think it's like almost 99% of the time you're going to be picking up a green mound Procummins Nana. And mm-hmm. that's a very specified cultivar for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's a lot of other instances where cultivars will play a key role in bonsai cultivation, as far as not just conifers, but also deciduous trees and broadleaf evergreens and even tropical plants tropical mm-hmm. plants are even more varied. We've talked about in the past where the Ficus microcarpa mm-hmm. has like a branch off system of like all these different plants that are technically the same plant,
mm-hmm.
but it looks 100% different. It's really hard for me even to start to crack the iceberg of what that means for plants to be able to be genetically altered. And this is also true, right? Because there's genetic alter through human intervention as well. Like going through and breeding plants with ideal traits to generate these cultivars as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. For sure. So maybe for beginners, the easiest place to start is when you're starting a bonsai, how do you start one? So you can collect a tree, and that's going to be likely a wild species, unless you're collecting from somebody's backyard, in which case you may end up with a cultivar of something. But say you're going up in the mountains and collecting a ponderosa. So that's just a wild species, no specific cultivar that we know of. So you can collect. You can start from a seed. And so that tree is going to be genetically unique. If it comes from a seed, it has different DNA from any other seed. And so that tree will be unique. Or you can do a cutting of something. And this is what we call cloning. This is how you keep cultivars true to their characteristics. All the plants within a cultivar are genetically identical. They're all clones that come from a single parental source. So every single azalea of a particular variety came from a azalea of that variety. They're all genetically identical, unless they decide to have a mutation and then that is propagated, which can happen, but just to kind of keep it basic, they're all genetically identical. So you can have a collected wild species, genetically unique, something from a seed, genetically unique. We'll just keep it simple for there. And
wait, cuttings, what was the last part?
I was going to say genetically unique from seed. Some seeds can... I don't know if anything comes true. No, some things come true from seed, but we won't go there. We'll just keep it more simple.
Okay.
And then, because I don't know the specifics of that. So we'll just say genetically unique from a seed, which is generally the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then cloning, which is a cutting, it's asexual reproduction. It's just creating more of the same thing. And those are all genetically identical.
And that's where it gets really interesting with certain trees and the way that they grow. And I mean, it reminds me of an article that I read from an old Bonsai Today magazine. And it was referenced in another article where we're on Bonsai Tonight, Jonas's online articles that he writes. He referenced a Japanese black pine article. I said the word article so many times, where it talked about this Japanese professional, bonsai professional, who was out in the woods. A Japanese black pine is native to his range, so they were literally in his backyard. Mm-hmm. And he would go explore the wood line and look for the characteristics that he liked in Japanese black pines as he ventured through the woods. And then he would make sure that he looked up into the growth habit of the branches, the needle size, the needle length, and the straightness. Because, I mean, we've seen this in Ponderosa pines, especially like curling needles or droopy needles, all kinds of crazy stuff. And so he would go through and he would collect seeds underneath the genetically ideal black pines, which is, if you think about it, it's like, I'm going to go ahead and just say, it's like, that's another layer of like bonsai insanity. It's like, I'm on the pursuit of perfection, and I will not accept a tree that has certain internode lengths, needle lengths, curled needles, and so on and so forth. And then you grow that from seed. And so it makes me wonder how many trees in bonsai have been started in that method. Because I think that method's also like, that's a very romanticized thought about bonsai as well, as like going out and finding the perfect plant for the genetic, for what you want. And then you raise that plant into a 30, 40 year old bonsai tree, and then it becomes a really well-known tree, and then people start cloning it. Is there a possibility for that? Because I know cultivar tagging, like, that has to, isn't it kind of like having like a copyright to a species in a way?
Yeah, it gets named officially in the nursery trade at some point. So that's how some cultivars are created. They are found in nature from either a spore growing off of a tree. So that's like a random genetic mutation on a tree where there's like one branch that has a different needle size or leaf shape or internode length or some other random characteristic on a tree. Sometimes these are called witch's brooms because it just looks very different on that tree. And so sometimes these are collected and then propagated and then introduced to the nursery trade as a new cultivar. Or like this person is doing, collecting seed, growing out seedlings, looking for ideal characteristics, throw out all the seedlings you don't want, keep the ones you do, and then continue propagating those or crossbreeding them to get more ideal characteristics. And once you can get that, like, once you can get that characteristic true, you know, in all of these, in all of its offspring, then you can get that named officially as a cultivar. So a lot of people do that, but don't get their trees or their species named. So like a lot of hobbyists I know will collect Japanese maple seedlings, grow them out and pick the ones that they like, toss out the other ones, and then, you know, continue propagating those the ones that they like. And, you know, they never make it into the nursery trade, but they become kind of like a cult favorite within your club or your group of friends of like, everybody's got this one maple that was propagated by this one person, but it's not officially anything. But yeah, that's how cultivars can get named. It can be a natural genetic mutation that people collect and propagate, or it can be something that is purposefully crossbred or grown out by humans, either through just selection over time or by purposefully crossbreeding and controlling which pollen goes to which flower to create a seed between those two parents.
And it's funny you mentioned the maple cultivar thing, because there's actually, there's a Japanese maple that we deal with here at the nursery in at Underhill, and it came from the Oregon area as a crossbreed. And so I can't remember the name of the nursery right now, but it is a dwarf that was amongst other cultivar preferred dwarf species. And then of course Japanese maples, if you're not aware, Carmen is, because she works with this species, but they're very like, they mingle very easily. So seedlings are very prominent amongst lots of Japanese maples. And so one of the little offshoots, little seedlings off of this actually came out to be very, very good for bonsai. Because it has a very tight internode, like a millimeter apart. And the cluster of leaves, and I've gotten this question, like the leaves are so clustered together that people actually have accused me of like growing marijuana at the nursery. It's that tight of an internode. It just, and it's not though.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But the leaf on a Japanese maple sometimes, you know, because of the daintiness of like how separated the what's the shape of that leaf called? It's really the pointiness of the leaf.
It's like a oh my God. It has like really sharp lobes. It's like a palmate. So it's like looks like your hand. Yeah. Like a palm.
There you go. The palmate with heavy serration. So it just, that's the way it looks.
Michael has this story where he took a Japanese maple on a train once. I don't remember. I think it was in the States. I'm not sure. But he took a Japanese maple. He took this on a train and people were staring at him like he had a marijuana plant or something on his lap. It's just a Japanese maple. But people confuse him all the time.
Wow.
It's really funny.
I know that there's a lot of people that listen to our show, but I don't think there's any like we're going to get like, what is it? Saying that word so many times that something's going to happen. Like they're going to be like, oh, gotta take it down. Been monetized. No, we're not talking about growing marijuana on this show.
Oh no, we're just talking about how maples sometimes look like that.
They just look like that, yeah. So don't worry. This is about bonsai still. But yeah, if you go over to our website, if you're in the States, you can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com. It's going to be under our dwarf Japanese maple nursery stock, APDF3. Is the SKU. We use SKUs on our website to make our lives easier in the descriptions. But we have it right there at the parent trees where natural dwarfs in open pollination from open pollination seeds by the means of their own roots and genetics. They are stable on the tree and will not revert back to any other, you know, expected like a green Japanese maple, like really long internodes and just like really on interesting bark. So there's nothing to revert back to because that's the tree and it's on its own roots. And that's something that's really, really important that I think a lot of people get excited and get into bonsai and don't realize is that they'll buy like, and this happens with Japanese maples a lot, is they'll buy a certain cultivar of Japanese maple and be like, this tree is so beautiful. And then they like pull the trunk down to like the Nabari roots and there's a graft. It's actually a grafted cultivar onto green maple stock. And it's something that I have to like kind of break down and distill for a lot of people when they come to the nursery and they see that or they mention like they'll show me a picture of a Japanese maple they have on their phone. They're like, can you help me with this? I can't seem to get it to grow right. It's unhealthy. And there's a lot of growth at the bottom and I don't know why it's doing that. And it's just, but this is another way that cultivars are used is that they are grafted straight onto stronger mother stock that would otherwise grow in your zone. Do you have any good notes on stuff like that as far as like grafting and?
Oh yeah, you can see this on white pines that are grafted onto Japanese black pine too. You see this mostly in the nursery trade. If you go to a nursery and you're looking through Japanese maples or if you're looking at like weeping cherries, sometimes the graft union is really, really obvious. Maybe not when you buy it as a young plant, but if you go through like your neighborhood and you look at everybody's Japanese maple in their front garden, you're going to see this weird swelling at the base. And that's where the graft union is. The bark below it looks different than the bark above it. There's this weird swelling in the middle. And so, yeah, just like Evan said, a lot of times what happens is the cultivated species, the cultivar will get put on top of the or will get grafted onto rootstock that is stronger and more hardy within the zone you live in to give that tree a better chance at survival in that environment. However, it's super ugly and you don't really want it for bonsai.
It's challenging.
Like weeping cherries, if you go in somebody's yard and look up under their weeping cherry, the graft unions on those are high up. They're like right above where the weeping part is. And so when they don't have leaves or flowers, you see this weird, hideous bulge kind of at the top under these weeping branches. I do not like it.
It's it's not as desirable trait.
So if you have a bonsai like this, like it's super useful in the nursery trade for making a lot of plants very quickly. It's really useful in fruit production. Apple trees are often grafted. Varieties are grafted onto stronger rootstock to get healthier, stronger plants. But if you have a bonsai like this, what you can do is you can air layer off the top of your Japanese maple off of that graft union and put it onto its own roots. It may be not as hardy in that case, in which, you know, then you might want to protect it a little bit more in the winter until you know what to expect with it. But there are ways to fix that so that you don't have to deal with a graft union. It just, it's much easier to buy something that does not have that than to try and air layer off of rootstock. But you can do it if you have a tree you really like that's grafted onto something else.
Yeah. And grafting is very obvious and very weird looking. Like Carmen said, it's got like a different color. The bark is a different shade. The like we have, you said, for example, Japanese maples. We've got Satsuma trees here that people like to grow a lot in Louisiana. And you can look at the citrus, the native citrus variety that would grow here naturally. And you can see where it literally has swollen out. Like it looks like a belly, like a like a tummy on like a creature. And then and then you can literally see the graft of the Satsuma poking out of it. Like it goes from like orange to white, whitish looking bark on the bottom. And grafting is, if you Google it, because we live in the world of, it's 2024, the world of the internet. And you look up stem grafting or veneer grafting, and you'll kind of get an idea. If you're not familiar with what a graft looks like, you haven't really seen that, or like with the process. Basically, you're taking the mother stock, like or the stronger stock that we're talking about here, and they essentially just stump it. And then after they stump it, and it could start really small, or for some citrus or fruiting varieties, it could even be pretty big. And then they'll cut a wedge into that stock, small or large, you know, whatever it might be. And then they'll stick the plant or the cultivar, what they want to grow, straight into it, like it's a puzzle piece, like it's perfectly cut to that. Then it's grafting tape is wrapped around it really nice and tight. Humidity is kept really high inside of the grafting tape because it adheres to itself and doesn't let it dry out. And then just naturally from the auxin moving through that shoot, and usually grafts are taken in late spring after first harden off and the next flush is coming, so that when that shoot goes to extend again, it sends the signal back down, and then the xylem and the phloem just perfectly matches back up because of the wedge cut. If it's done correctly, it's just like the plant doesn't know the difference, especially being in the same species.
Have you ever watched a professional graft things, like not like a bonsai professional, like a nursery person? Just they do so many so fast, and the percentage of success is
pretty high.
Astounding. Yeah. Because like we're over here grafting like shimpaku onto shimpaku, like it takes me a few minutes per graft. They're doing it in like 2 seconds, like I'm over here like very carefully wrapping, and then have like 30% success rate. Like it's ridiculous. So
grafting is, oh, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
No, you're fine.
It's like grafting is like its own skill within the nursery trade. And it's not even something that, like, because like from bonsai to, so just like bonsai professional, just like somebody more along the lines of like curator. You, Carmen, you probably don't, like back at the university, you probably don't have to graft plants very often. Like you will.
I probably will. I never did before I came here. Now that I know how and have a lot of practice and have a better idea of what I want trees to look like, I definitely will be doing some grafting when I get back. But yeah, a lot of people, even bonsai hobbyists, like, you know, you don't necessarily have enough stock to even practice on. You know, like you do a couple grafts here and there, or you have somebody who knows how to do it for you, because it's a skill that you can learn, you know, but it's like wiring. You have to just do it a lot in order to get the muscle memory, the feeling of how to do it and how to do it correctly.
It's like for bonsai training and stuff, we learn how to wire, we learn how to trim, we learn how to like do things at certain times of the year and look for certain signals in the plants. Whereas if we wanted to learn how to graft, we would have to go to a completely different environment and go to like a citrus grafting nursery and just graft day in and day out to really get that down. Because like you said, like the take on bonsai is not as, you know, it's not as successful. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a couple of other factors there too. Is because like, we don't do it very often, but also the other factors could be like, we're grafting young material onto very old trunks in some cases.
Exactly. Yep.
And that can affect the take, right? Because of the mm-hmm. older material.
Mm-hmm. And some stuff that we're grafting, we're not doing like seedling apple onto seedling apple. We're doing like juniper cutting onto 50-year-old juniper, you know, like it's so the vigor of those plants is different. Our cutting is a much different size than the branch we're putting it on. And I think it's important to note here too that, you know, we've just kind of disparaged the look of graft unions, but grafting is super important to bonsai, but in a different way. We tend to not graft trunk onto trunk. We tend to graft onto branches to fill in gaps. Except if we're doing like a white pine on a Japanese black pine trunk, then we just kind of try to hide the graft union there because that one can be kind of obvious. But usually we're not doing it like how they do Japanese maples or apples or the Satsuma like you're talking about. Usually we're grafting branches into bare spots. We're not always changing the variety. A lot of times we're grafting the same thing onto the same plant, just in a different location.
Yeah, mastery of grafting really comes whenever someone shows you a bonsai and you look at it, and then that person tells you that's all that foliage has been replaced and grafted, by the way. And then you have to double take it and you're like, oh. And then you have to look for the graft unions. That's whenever someone's done a good job, is if they can hide this grafts from you and fully replace the foliage,
Oh, go. You can go ahead. I was cutting you off. Sorry.
No. Yeah, I was about to mention Michael.
I was going to say my favorite are the ponderosa trunks that have black pine foliage. So it looks like a super old black pine, but it's actually like a little tiny ponderosa where the needles were too big for the trunk size. And so I would just change the whole foliage, just make it black pine. And then you look to see where the graft unions are. And on a couple of them, it's just one graft union. So you're like, oh God, I hope that never fails, because then the whole tree's gone. But usually you want more than one to take, but we've built whole trees off of a single graft. So it's really amazing.
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai, and I just wanted to tell you guys about Save Bonsai. It's going to be happening from March 28th to the 30th, 2025. We're going to be everything Louisiana for a full weekend, so we're going to include a crawfish boil, homemade gumbo, and other food trucks and vendors that are very special, I guess you can say, the southern culture of Louisiana. And also the show will include a bonsai show with its own special awards, including Best in Show, Best Shohin, Best Traditional Design, People's Choice Award, and also a tongue-in-cheek Best Bald Cypress Bonsai Award. Guest artists and visiting artists will include Julian Tsai, Sylvia Smith, Mike Lane, Carmen Lesko-Bianski, Dawn Ketting, Randy Bennett, and Guy Guidry. Each artist will be presenting demonstrations and giving workshops throughout the weekend. You can go over to underhillbonsaistore.com and go under our Save Bonsai Workshops tab, and you can sign up for just regular attendance. It's going to be $25 just to get into the exhibit tent, And then all the workshops will be spaced out and they will all have individual pricing. We hope to see you guys there.
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
Hey guys, it's Evan with Underhill Bonsai and, of course, The Little Things. And we want to just let you know that we have a scholarship fund for bonsai education that's going to be supplied by The Little Things ourselves as well as Joshua Rath Tools. John said he is excited about the scholarship and that he wanted to do his own contribution as well. John will be contributing $200 worth of Joshua Roth tools to the scholarship fund as well. So in addition to being able to go to a local bonsai establishment, either it be a bonsai nursery or a bonsai professional, and seek training or classes through them, Joshua Roth will also send you a nice beginner set of $200 worth of tools to fit your needs for your bonsai goals and dreams. Something that people don't think about for bonsai is that, especially junipers, this happens junipers a lot, the entire tree could be built off of a single branch. And a lot of people will not look into that because whenever we're building a bonsai out, especially from raw stock, the rule is always, where's your first branch, your defining branch of the tree? Where's your second branch? Where's the crown start to form? How is the branch laid out on each individual part of the tree? But then junipers are not as flexible as, like, say, a deciduous tree where we can just cut back and hope for backbudding in certain areas. So a lot of those junipers and a lot of pine trees, too, I've seen this a lot, are built off of literally just one branch that comes off the top of the tree or off the side, and then it's curled up and around, and then subset branches are growing off of that one piece. And David DeGroot, I don't want to say his name wrong because I've said it wrong a lot. He was giving a lecture at Louisiana Day of Bonsai years ago when I was first getting into bonsai, and he made a really great statement that conifers are built off of a single line.
Oh, yeah.
And it broke it down in my brain so easy. When you think so, it's like keep it simple, stupid kind of concept. It's just like, that's it. You know, you don't have to think too hard, because if you clear out all the branches you don't need and you leave that one long branch that seems kind of whippy and long, you can build a whole tree off of that. And so whenever we say full replacement of foliage and we talk about conifers, that to me, that's terrifying, because we don't deal with a lot of conifers in Southeast Louisiana because it's humid here. We don't get a lot of great species. We are in the works of trying to get some one seed junipers and some ash junipers in the future here. We'll see how that goes. But for now, getting a big old one of the species that we can get here a lot is Parsoni. Our Parsons juniper. It's a very good species of juniper. Very, very strong. I'm just gonna be honest, I have abused that species. Like, I've done some heinous stuff to that tree. like taking them and, like, you know, big and small ones, and just done some really crazy stuff to them, and they just take it. Like, they are very strong. And so I can imagine a full graft replacement of Parsoni to a Shumpaku, which is possible. Mike has told me that he's done that before. It's not something out of the question that you can do. It's just like, for our listeners out there, so you know that junipers cannot be cut back to a stub. There's no way. Juniper will die. It has to have foliage. So for full replacement, you have to balance the old foliage and also graft new foliage on, grow out the new foliage to the point where you know that the graft union is not going to cut off the lifeline of the tree. And when you cut off the old foliage, that the lifeline of the graft will survive. That's a scary challenge.
Yeah. But it's tricky.
If you do it right, though, the payoff could be huge.
Yeah, you can get a really nice tree in a pretty short amount of time with that method. We do that a lot. And we were talking about black pine onto ponderosa. That's kind of a really tricky graft to do. Ponderosa, you know, that's just it's kind of hard to graft onto a ponderosa.
Pine grafting is crazy, too. It's a candle. Yeah. It just looks weird to me.
Yeah. But with juniper, we do a lot of foliage replacement because a lot of Rocky Mountain juniper have really cool trunks, but and the Western junipers too. They've got really cool old trunks, but the foliage is just like weepy
and weird. Yeah,
it can be really kind of nasty. Some are really nice, and those ones, you know, we try to keep the original foliage if we can. But on the kind of ones that have a great trunk but not so great foliage, we replace them with shimpaku. We replace some of the chinensis with shimpaku. We've got some kind of in process now. We've got one where a Western trunk where I cut off the old foliage and now it's just shimpaku. You know, I did that 2 years ago. So it takes a few years for your grafts. Like once they take, it takes a couple of years for them to get strong enough for you to cut off that old foliage, but you start to reduce that old foliage without reducing any of the new foliage. And then eventually you can make that final cut and just totally transition it. But yeah, that's a really good way to use trunks that otherwise have real yucky foliage on them.
And just as a reference, because I have seen the tree and worked on it with you, is the mm-hmm. fish.
Ah, yes, the fish.
If you go to Michael's, you go to cartagus.com. And you go to his gallery and you go to his conifers. There's a Rocky Mountain juniper in his collection that has this big, giant, curled piece of deadwood. And then it has a big offshoot that sticks up in the air like a fishtail. Uh-huh. That tree is Rocky Mountain foliage.
Yes, we
which
have.
Which is crazy.
We have a couple very sizable Rocky Mountains in the garden with their original foliage. And so you can kind of beat it back over time to get, you know, that kind of density. It's never going to look like a shimpaku, but I think there's some merit in keeping the original foliage on some of these really old collected trees instead of trying to change it into something that it's not.
Isn't Pacific Bonsai Museum, isn't Captain Hook also on its original foliage?
I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that tree.
Give it a Google really quick. Okay. We're sponsored by Google now.
Right.
we say like for references and stuff so often, but look up Captain Hook Pacific Bonsai Museum. Once you see the tree, you'll know which one I'm talking about. You've seen this tree before. It's quite popular now in North American bonsai scene. It was styled by Ryan Neal. But its foliage looks like Rocky Mountain to me. With a bit really big, wicked looking twisted deadwood piece that there's a hook piece that sticks out of the bottom of the pot intentionally, giving its name Captain Hook. You see it?
Yeah, I think it might be a Sierra.
That's a Sierra California juniper?
I think so. It's one of the natives. It is native foliage. So okay. Yeah, that one's not grafted.
So
that's pretty nice. Yeah.
Oh yeah, there you go, Sierra. It's a Juniperus occidentalis.
Occidentalis.
Yeah, there you go. Leave it to the horticulturist. So that's another example of a juniper that was collected wild, Yamadori, and then kept its native foliage on it. And then you can kind of see it if you look at other pictures of junipers. If you look up Pacific Bonsai Museum, you'll see like on the photos, you'll see a bunch of different junipers. Any juniper that you see on there that's got like really lush, deep, kind of like emerald green, like blue green almost, foliage, and they're tight, that's going to be a replacement foliage.
Mm-hmm.
Native foliages are kind of like this yellowy, light blue green, not deep mm-hmm. blue. Typically, and then sometimes, like I think Captain Hook in some of these photos that I've seen, this tree even has like its juniper berries on it, which is really lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you don't really get when you cross over to shimpaku, unless your shimpaku foliage gets really old. Some older collected varieties of junipers will have their juniper berry or false like flower foliage, like a Brocumans will get.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just something that it's kind of like this battle. Do you want the true genetics of your native and you want to deal with the, like you said, Carmen, like the Rocky Mountain, the foliage. And I've witnessed this when I worked on that tree. Mm-hmm. It's floppy.
Mm-hmm.
It will not stand without wire on it. So you have to wire that tree like 100% of its life. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if you unwire it, everything's just going to fall and sag, and then it left to its own devices and not pinched properly. It just turns back into this mess.
Mm-hmm. We're at the point with some of it where we've done enough wiring and it's growing strong enough that some of the new growth doesn't need wires. And that's a really fun point to get to with Rocky Mountain, because a lot of times, especially the first, I don't know, 5 years, longer than that, they have to be wired up or they just get floppy. Eventually, you could start to get them not to be, but it takes a long time. And you have to have kind of a smaller foliage on that tree to begin with. So,
yeah, it's really interesting, because we had also talked about, we did an episode where we talked about some of the bald cypresses that I was caring for in my own collection, and they're collected trees. And bald cypress is a very vigorous species, but getting them to slow down and then not having to control every single piece of foliage. Mm-hmm. Instead, I can wire, and then the new stuff is so vigorous and so strong, and then everything is balanced. Mm-hmm. The tree will grow and then stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a beautiful feeling.
Yeah, that's really nice.
You're like, okay, I'm tired of pinching you. And the tree's like, okay, well, I'm just old enough that it doesn't matter right now.
Yeah,
you're
I've got enough tips now. It feels like limber pine too, especially like, you know, you get a young limber pine and it's kind of sparse, but it has so much vigor because it's so like new as a bonsai. But then after 10 years, it finally has enough new buds, new tips, and the density to kind of be slow and just slowly extend and then stop, and then you just kind of gently manage instead of lots of pruning and lots of wiring and lots of rebending and all this stuff. So
fun fact, and also my 2 cents on bald cypress cultivation and care: treat them like a conifer and they will grow like that. That's something I learned recently too. So I know we have a lot of bald cypress bonsai enthusiasts out there listening to the show. No, it's something, it's a recent discovery where I'm like, wow, you treat them like a conifer.
If you treat a conifer like a conifer, it'll grow like a conifer.
And it slows down and all the tips harden off. And then it just becomes like a growth habit of a conifer. And if you treat it like a deciduous tree, it will grow like a deciduous tree.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the fun part about it. But yeah, I wanted to go in and look at, and I wonder if I would need to message Aaron Packard about this. But I would love to like have a picture of Captain Hook as like maybe the cover of this episode, because I do want to talk about Captain Hook a little bit, because we were talking about a second ago how junipers are built off of a single line.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, there's a picture of Captain Hook. Let's see. I'm going to copy the image. I'm going to send it over so you know exactly which one I'm talking about into the chat here for you. There we go. You can see it really good in this photo, and I'm gonna share this photo. I mean, it's free to share that kind of stuff. It's not my image, so I'll say where it came from on our Instagram. But yeah, if you look at that from this angle, someone took this picture, you can actually see that single branch that whole tree is built off of at the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a couple, but it's not as many branches as you think. It's really interesting that you really only need 2 or 3 secondary branches, or like even just 1 branch, and then build, grow and build secondaries off of that. It's pretty amazing what you can do. Oh, wait, I see it better now. I zoomed in.
Yep.
Yeah, there's one. Yep. Mm-hmm.
It looks like one piece, and then all the branches come off of that one piece.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like this fountain down kind of shape that if you go to a bonsai show, and this is something that I've heard other professionals say, especially I've heard This was actually on a shout out to Bjorn's old podcast show. I miss his show. He had a great show where he said, go to a high end show and look up into the canopies of old junipers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, challenge yourself to get in and under. Don't like get in there, like, but get
look
down.
Look from underneath. Yeah.
Look from underneath. Don't put your hands in there and like start separating the foliage. But yeah, look up in there, because the majority of the time, a lot of those branches come from that one spot. And mm-hmm. it will help you break that down. So if you're ever considering on doing a graft and changing the genetics on a juniper or pine or whatever, I mean, it could be a deciduous tree, tropical tree, whatever. I will say that tropicals and deciduous trees are way easier to pull off a graft or foliage chain on them, change on them, and mm-hmm. make it still a little bit more convincing.
Mm-hmm.
But a problem with deciduous trees is that we typically show our deciduous trees out of leaf is really like the most impressive time to see the ramification and like what we've done. And grafts become more obvious at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But Mike, referencing to Mike Lane, he's done grafting and work on sea hibiscus that's phenomenal. I don't know if you've seen mm-hmm. some of Mike's full foliage conversions on some of the sea hibiscus varieties.
I haven't. I'll have to go look through that.
You can't see it because Mike has gotten to that point where he gets the bones of the tree, like the main branch structure of the tree, lobs those back to the internode space that he needs the graft to start at, and then he veneer grafts straight into the end of that branch.
Wow.
It's beautiful. And it takes, and then he heals the wound properly. Like he talks about in previous episodes of the show, he's like, let it grow out. And if you got two and it grows out and blows out to a certain extent, it will heal that wound. And you want to completely, and you know, you hear Mike saying that mm-hmm. in your head. But he does that very, very well and elegantly. And then those branches will in turn, those new grafts will turn into new branches and they'll divide and then get smaller. And then you won't even know. And it heals very well and it looks great. On some species, it's very easy to pull that off. I don't know if I've ever spotted a full replacement on like a deciduous tree that was obvious to me, because typically deciduous trees are grown on their own roots when it comes to that kind of stuff.
I feel like you don't really, there's not really a, I feel like if you're at a point with a tree where you have to replace all the foliage, you might as well just grow a different tree.
Mm-hmm. And that's another part of the conversation.
With a deciduous, with a conifer, a different story. But with a deciduous, a lot of times, unless you're just adding one or two branches or changing one or two things, a lot of times I feel like maybe it's not worth it to change the entire foliage. You'd have to have a really amazing trunk to want to do that. And a lot of deciduous, I feel, grow pretty quickly, and I don't know, maybe that's a hot take.
Yeah, not downplaying deciduous trees.
Oh no. Just but, I think as far as grafting goes, it's kind of a different story.
But I did learn recently that in the like Cocofu 10 and like the categorization of how the trees are judged, mm-hmm. junipers and conifers and stuff are kind of like they're in like their own suite of like being judged.
Mm-hmm.
And then deciduous trees are in a category that is basically called miscellaneous.
How rude.
That's just how it is.
I feel like it's I don't mind them being judged separately, because I think it's a completely different skill set to grow a really good deciduous over a really good conifer. But and you know, sometimes the things you're looking for are different, but miscellaneous feels a little bit dismissive.
Well, because it kind of feels that way, but that's the kind of way that like the Japanese culture views bonsai in that way. It's like junipers and pines are pretty superior. I mean, that's mm-hmm. what the basis of Japanese bonsai aesthetic is built off of.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the deciduous trees are like the playthings is kind of what I've seen. But I mean, there's some really, really high level deciduous trees in Japan, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
But it's so hard to pull off that, because like we're talking about foliage replacement and genetics and trees. And I wanted to go back to like the Rocky Mountains and then also the Sierra juniper that we were talking a second ago, the Captain Hook tree, is desirable foliage habits on these trees. That what kind of purist are you when it comes to your tree? Does that make sense?
Like, at what point would I replace the foliage?
Yeah, like at what point do you are you like, I'm honoring this North American native, or or there's that like purest like Japanese preferred species? So what for from me to you to like being like in a crap. Keep wanting to say cultivar, but it's actually wow.
It's okay. It's
curator says curator.
Yes. Yes.
So from me to you being a curator of bonsai like this, where is the line drawn where you see I should replace the foliage, or this foliage is good enough that it would honor this tree?
I mean, this really plays right into our genetics conversation of the variety of morphologies you can find in wild collected stuff. So you could collect a Rocky Mountain that already has kind of small, denser foliage that's not quite as floppy. And, you know, so, and that genetic is very different than a Rocky Mountain that has really stringy, floppy foliage that may never kind of tighten up over time. So I think
it's a tough question.
I'm definitely not. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it. I want the tree to be the best tree that it can be. So if I can maintain the natural foliage in a way that, you know, is in scale with the tree and gives the right aesthetic, I'm going to keep the natural foliage. If the trunk is a 6, a 7, a 10, you know, if it's a really, really high rated trunk, but the foliage is just crap and like, I don't think it's ever going to tighten up, I want that tree to be the best it can be. So at that point, I would change over the foliage. And I think as a curator, I can also use the excuse of education as far, you know, as far as like, this
it's
is
my job.
This is my job. Like I can demonstrate this technique, you know, like how you can do this really cool scientific thing to make a tree even better. But I always really do love the native trees with their native foliage. I feel like if you can do that, if you could make that work, I think I prefer that. But if you have a really amazing trunk, I'm not going to say, don't change your foliage. Like these little ponderosa trunks out in the yard, like they would look stupid with ponderosa needles on them because the trunks are so small. So, but that trunk is worthy of being shown. And I could, and you know, Michael made that amazing by changing the foliage. So I think it really is kind of on a tree by tree basis. And, you know, maybe at some point we'll have some Rocky Mountain cultivars in the trade that we can switch over to. So we're not switching to shiitake, we're switching to a small needle.
You hear that? Other
Rocky Mountain.
Other bonsai growers and practitioners out there that have an interest in collecting Rocky Mountains and other alpine natives. The North American scene doesn't really have a cultivar to kind of go over to just yet. And I know as a grower myself, it's kind of our job to kind of venture into that zone of like finding cultivars or finding preferred habits on trees. Because Carmen's the curator who's dealing with these things. And then as a grower, and it's not my field because I'm not an alpine range, but that would be something that I think would be well worth it for somebody to look into, especially if they're dealing with a lot of collected stock like that. Of course it would take a lot of trial and error, and I don't know if it's, you know, is it ultimately worth it? If you could nail down a cultivar of Rocky Mountain juniper, yes, for sure. Because then it would solve a lot of issues that we have with maintain. Like you said, it would be beautiful if you could maintain the native foliage with the tree because it truly represents the range.
Yeah. And I mean, and some people don't like the look. Some people want that juniper look of the really dense green shimpaku look. And that's fine. That's personal preference. I just happen to be partial to, I guess, keeping natives native if you can.
Yeah. And I also preach that a lot too, about take a native plant and really give it a shot. And if it doesn't work out, then it doesn't work out, but there still isn't, it's still not going to be not possible, a double negative. It's still possible. It's just you have to find your way to make it work. Like it's the, for instance, like the vaccinium that grows here natively. I had a lot of issues with them. They're a beautiful species. Would it be better if I just try to grow like a production blueberry or a known blueberry species that just does well? Yeah. It was something hardier, but the native one here in Louisiana, the Vaccinium Elliotti, the Elliott's wild blueberry that grows just underbrush, understory here, has a beautiful little tiny leaf, beautiful little tiny clusters of flowers that turn into singular blueberries, not a, like a bundle of blueberries. And I had to really like go through the trials with those trees and find out what I was doing wrong. And now I've got something that resembles bonsai, but like you said, it's not ideal. It doesn't look like what people expect. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to lean into that.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, it's this whole discussion of, you know, Japanese traditional bonsai and why did they make it look that way? Is that what they're seeing in nature? Is that what their ideal is? And that's fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I think there's something about using our native species and finding our way with their natural look. It just, it kind of evokes this feeling of being in that habitat. And, you know, I like that feeling, that connection. That's part of the reason why I like to do bonsai and create little kusumono that remind me of these places I've been. So I don't always want a tree to look, you know, like your characteristic bonsai. I want it to look like the place that it reminds me of. So different aesthetic choices, different feelings we're trying to evoke. And I think they're all valid as long as we know why we're doing them.
Yeah.
Unless you make it look stupid, then what are you even doing?
I wasn't going to bring that up. There aren't any stupid bonsai out there. Don't listen to her.
Okay.
Yeah. Now it's, so there's a, there are a lot of challenging things to designing bonsai depending on their growth habits and their species and their varieties. And there are some trees that going to genetics, kind of like getting towards the end of the conversation here, wrapping it up, is that some trees and back just based off their genetics are just not really built to be a bonsai. And I know we just talked about this liberation of like, oh, we got a native species. It's got its native foliage on it. It looks great. We're going with it. We're giving it nuance, letting it be its own thing and not having to stick to the Japanese model. And so this tree might not necessarily have the branch placement that would tell you this is bonsai, but it has its own habitat kind of feel to it. Whereas some trees are just like, we're going to have, you have to draw the line at some point that the genetics, the growth habit, the internode spacing, the leaf size, the even some plants, I've found that some plants just don't want to be grown in a container. Like they just struggle with it. So that those are the things that were that this line is drawn here, where we kind of get to the end of this thought is like, well, if we can play with all these genetics, talk about grafting, talk about cultivars and why they're important to the nursery trade, and then doubly so to the bonsai world, then we get to a point where it's like everything can be a bonsai. And then we get to that point where it's like, not really.
Not really.
Mm-hmm. It's close. Everything's flexible, but not, you know.
At some point, the genetics just don't work. Like you said, they just don't like pot culture, or you can't get the reduction, or you can't get the growth, or you can't get the look, or, you know, there's a number of things that could get in the way genetically. But I mean, the whole, there's usually a variety of it out there somewhere, maybe eventually, that could become a bonsai. Like I'm ever hopeful that eventually maybe there'll be a variety of this that could work. But go to a, I recommend people go to botanical gardens and look at conifer collections. There's some really bizarre stuff out there. Or go to a landscape nursery, not like your local nursery, like go to like a professional landscape tree nursery. I found like 50 varieties of Eastern white pine. And I was like, how come we aren't using these for bonsai? Because everybody's like, oh, you can't do Eastern white pine. And I'm that person that went under a tree that had a weird spore on it and collected a bunch of seedlings and I'm growing them out. But yeah. I could have just gone to this nursery and been like, oh, look, they have a white pine with short internodes. Why am I not growing that? So there's a lot of stuff we don't even know about because it's not at Lowe's or Home Depot or your local perennial, you know, your local landscape nursery where, you know, people want a certain 50 woody plants. They don't want the weird one. They want that one.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of weird stuff out there if you look for it.
And that just tells me that we, as bonsai practitioners and also people who are just experimenting with plants, we just need to try more. Like, do more things.
Sure.
You know, like, of course, we need to master the horticultural aspect of it first. We need to keep the plants healthy, keep them thriving, and then we could start playing around. So if you feel like you're at this point with your bonsai career or bonsai care, we highly recommend that you guys start playing around. Just try certain things, different things.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, nothing's with like out of reason.
Yeah.
To try.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, throw a handful of Japanese maple seeds into a flat and see what comes up next year. And if anything's worth growing out, or when you're walking in the woods, look up and look for witches' brooms and weird sports coming off of trees. And if you're able to collect some of that and propagate it, do it, try it, just see what happens. Even watch your bonsai. We have an azalea here that every couple of years throws out a weird sport off of it. So like it has this random genetic mutation that looks smaller and more condensed. And so it's already a cultivar, but it decided it wants to have this other weird branch. And so I've been trying to propagate it. So even look at your own trees in your yard or your own bonsai. And if you see a weird branch or something that's different, could it be a random genetic mutation? Maybe.
Yeah. And like, that's kind of where it is, like dare to be different with it.
Uh-huh.
Because what stands out the most to me personally, whenever I'm going through like a bonsai display area and I'm like going to like high end display at a show, it's like, there's a juniper, there's a pine tree, there's a really nice elm, you know, deciduous style. And then we see something that's just really weird.
Mm-hmm.
That usually makes a mark, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember that tree because it was so individualized. I'm like, oh, that was one of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what bonsai aims to really be, is one of a kind, you know. And there's a lot of bonsai out there. There's thousands and thousands of trees out there, and they're all fighting to be their own individuals. And I think one of the things that just ironically wins me over is whenever I know the history of a tree or I've seen a tree and I'm like, that's a true individual. And then the artist took that individual sport or some discovered cultivar of their own, and then they made something really special out of it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, you were saying that to me the other day. It's like you have this completely individual tree that you collected and styled, but then if it is a wild collected thing, its genetic is also 100% unique. So it's unique in so many different ways. It is truly one of a kind, and that kind of blows your mind if you think about it.
Yeah, sit there and like go down this like the rabbit's hole, like kind of like Alice in Wonderland thing where you just fall into this infinite, like there's so many possibilities, and then you just like, get wrapped up in it. And but then it's just like you're looking at this tree where, yeah, like one of my bald cypresses, the leaf is slightly shorter and the branches grow laterally instead of straight upwards. And I'm like, oh, this is special. But it's like,
that is special.
It's
you should propagate that.
It's so it's such a minimal difference between other trees. You know what I mean?
But you noticed.
But you notice it. And also it could come in to like the care as well. Like I was stressing earlier about treating like conifers. It could also come into this, the fact that I organically fertilize and I treat them a certain way and yada, yada. So, but I know there's a genetic difference in some of the trees that I have in my collection, because in my personal collection, like I think, let me see, I'm trying to pick my brain real quick about the few trees that I know are from a, like a landscape nursery. The, you know, like 90% of my trees are collected. So they're all genetically unique and they come with all their own genetic challenges. So, and to kind of offshoot that real quick, I do have a couple of problem trees that the genetics just don't line up, even though I did everything I was supposed to. Because of the tree's genetics, it's just some trees are weaker. It's like the same thing going back to like talking about the Japanese black pine propagation, where they just like a closing note on this is like I took a bunch of Japanese black pine seeds that I got from a local source and grew them all out, and half of the seedlings were just not, they're not meant to survive. Like they're just weak.
They're just not good. Yeah. They're not going to survive to pass on that genetic trait.
Yep. And sometimes that happens, you know. And so you might collect a tree out of the wild and you're like, this tree looks awesome and it looks old and twisted. It might be old and twisted looking for other reasons, and you collect it and it ends up dying. So you just have to be careful with those things too.
Yeah.
Anyway, any closing remarks on cultivars or genetic special things about trees?
I just think, I mean, it's just interesting. I haven't thought about plant genetics for a while, so I'm glad you brought it up, because I was just thinking back to this class I had in college that was, you know, required for my major, and the teacher was new and not very great, and I got through it, but I don't feel like I got as much out of it as I could have. But then I worked in a plant genetics lab for a year, and that was super bizarre, doing plant crosses under a microscope at 7 o'clock in the morning, and just bizarre stuff, but really fascinating the things that people can do and learn through the manipulation of plants. And I guess, I mean, we talked about a lot here, so I guess I'm curious, especially for folks who are in our Discord, or if you follow us on Instagram or anything, if you have questions or you want to hear more about any of this in particular, let us know, and maybe we can deep dive into it on another episode, because we kind of covered a lot of the basics here. We went over a lot of information, but if there's, you know, something more specific or something you want us to revisit, let us know, because some of these sciencey things can get dense and rabbit holey and, you know how it goes. Oh, look at how the sun is shining through this window. It's so lovely.
It has
I've got like a god sunbeam shining on me this morning. It's just so lovely.
We've been talking for so long that the sun, the angle changed, and
yeah, it's in my eyes, and it's like, get off the computer, go do work.
Yeah,
I don't wanna.
It's about that time.
I guess so.
Before we wrap up, though, do need to mention real quick. We mentioned it on a previous episode, but we'll plug it again. We have the Little Things for Bonsai People Scholarship Award that we'll be awarding to anyone that wants to acquire about it. So you can hit me up at evan@underhillbonsai.com. You can just send me an email. What we're looking for is a story about your bonsai life and career, what your goals are. If you want to refer back to our previous episode about bonsai goals to kind of give yourself a springboard or a starting point, and kind of see where inspiration lies with bonsai. If this is something that is like you're really into, you want to learn more about bonsai and get educated more, and you've been listening to the show, you're already, you know, pretty much like prerequisites are kind of taken care of. You listen to a lot of our content, and you want to pursue in-person mentorship or education for bonsai, we are awarding $200 to whatever endeavor you have. And we will contact the bonsai professional or bonsai nursery establishment, whatever you might be, where you might be learning from, and help you get those classes for that dollar amount that you're looking for. Or
let us give you our money.
Yes. Let us help you help yourself learn how to do bonsai. But yeah, like I said, just send me an email, evan@underhillbonsai.com, and tell me your bonsai story. Tell me why you are eligible for the award. And then we will announce the person who will get a certificate of little things. What is that? What's the name that you say, what you would say for a certificate? I've got a thing on my wall here. Excellence in little things. Oh,
like an award of excellence. An award of excellence in little things.
Yeah. There you go.
That's hilarious. We have to come up with a really good name for it.
Yeah. And we will.
I like that. I like that.
So, yeah. So thank you guys for supporting the show, but we'd like to give back. And then, of course, go on and mention real quick, plug the Say Bonsai 2025, because it is a bonsai show that I'm putting on, and this is my podcast show, so I can do that. So Say Bonsai 2025 is going to be happening it's going to be March 28th to the 30th. It's going to feature the Little Things live recording. So me, Mike, and Carmen are going to be there hanging out. We're going to have a demo and several workshops you guys can attend, and other bonsai artists that will be attending include Julian Tsai, Sylvia Smith, Dawn Ketting, Randy Bennett, and Guy Guidry. So we got
a good lineup. I'm excited. This is going to be really fun.
We've got a great lineup, and you can attend a workshop for each one of those bonsai artists. Yes, we took 3 days and I sat down and did a schedule and I actually made it work. So really looking forward to it. So if you guys are interested, you can just keep checking Underhill's Facebook page for more information. We should be posting availability for purchasing tickets. And once we get the schedule for the workshops ironed out and the materials selected for our workshops, then we'll also have the ability to purchase those workshops, get some early bird specials on those. So just give us some time. Having to plan on a show is pretty tough. And then, yeah,
especially with a little tiny baby.
Yes, especially with baby Rory.
Is he going to be a headliner at the show?
He probably will. He probably will be, honestly. He'll be old enough by then to hold something in his hands.
Yeah, he'll have a workshop or something.
Yeah, he'll hold a workshop of cooing and trying to say his first words. So you guys
it'll be Carmen.
It's probably going to be Shimpaku Juniper. There, and it'll be like, oh, God, I can't
bonsai.
Do this. No, I'm sure it'll be something like Mama. I'm going to be disappointed.
Oh, Mama.
Yeah. Anyway, so go ahead and say our patrons real quick at the end of each episode, like I always do. Starting off with Wallace Woods Pottery, Bonsai Samurai, Raton Studio, Kyle Ford, Wesley Thompson, Joseph Dubinque, David Smith, Eddie Fernandez, Byron Myrick Pottery, Chantel Wynn, His Warrior, Christina Carforia, Jay Boccaccini, Gilbert Jorez, She Saw Sean Seaman. You know it's bad when I do the very first one and I get I stutter on the first name. Barry's Bonesai, James Stewart Woodworking, Joshua Roth Limited, Nancy Hoffman, Nate Murray, Ben Crean, Victrina Ridgeway, Timothy Arsenal,
Tim,
he's actually going to be in my neck of the woods soon. He messaged me a little while ago. He's going to come visit Underhill. It's exciting. Chris Fossoon, J.A.S. Potts, Bonsai Marine, A.C. Castle, Luis Torres, Karen Codswell, Austin Adkins, David N., Chase, Taylor Peacock, Greenwich Gardens, Backyard Bonsai Australia, Justin Knight, Joel Jenkins, Ryan Gordando, Snappy Chappers, Joshua Bentley. I'm not even going to try it anymore.
We should just record him replay it so you don't have to struggle through it. I'll say it.
I don't need a clip show of me mispronouncing words. Matt, please don't do that to me. Ricky Ruins, Boyd Snellgrove, Vicky Auth, and Montana Bridgman, Specimen Best Buds, Anra UN, and Bill's Bayou. Thank you guys so much for sponsoring our show. Every little bit counts, and it doesn't matter at what level you sponsor at us at, the $1, the $5, the $30. It supports the little things. It keeps us, you know, working, happy, being able to do this show for you guys, providing all the information that we possibly can. And hopefully little things will keep chugging forward towards episode 100 and beyond. So thank you guys so much. But yeah, if you guys want to check out more information about me or Underhill Boneside, you can go over to underhillboneside.com. I have some articles there that I've written about some projects that I've worked on. I've got the store, underhillbonesaistore.com. That's where, say, Boneside 2025 tickets will be available and workshop tickets soon. We also have Little Things merch available on that website. And then you can go over to Instagram and Facebook, of course, Underhill Boneside, and you can follow us there. I have my personal account on Facebook as well. I think it's converted over to where it just, you don't have to friend me anymore. You can just follow it. I don't know. It's the same. It's going to be essentially the same content. So if you're already a friend there, you already know what's going on. For Mike Lane, we love you, buddy, but we're going to have to shout you out every time. it's not a problem. KitsuneBoneside.com. Mike Lane is a South Florida bonsai artist specializing in tropicals and shohin, and now he's going more into medium-sized bonsai. Recently, he's doing some excellent work on some really good showstoppers. I think he's going to be, you know, I don't think we want to spoil anything. I think he's going to be using them for some upcoming shows. So expect to see a lot more of Mike's work soon here. But he also travels across the United States and teaches bonsai to the masses. He's a great teacher. And then for you, Carmen, where do they check your stuff out at?
You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Becoming Bonsai. And be sure to check out the Purple Pot Society, the national women's group that inspires and encourages women to get more involved in bonsai. You don't have to be a woman to join, but all of the membership goes to, all the membership funds go to supporting women in bonsai.
Awesome. Yep. And gives you a reason to collect purple pots.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. So acquired a few myself. And because you mentioned it like way earlier on, it's like there's not a lot of purple pots.
I see like so many more of them now. I feel like it's I don't know if it's just because I'm noticing them or if they've actually become more of a thing, but I've been seeing them around. So I get excited every time I see one.
Yeah. So yep, you guys support other clubs. Go to your local bonsai club. Go hang out. Become part of a bonsai community and keep growing bonsai. Make some cultivars. So you guys have a great week and we'll check up with you guys on the next one.
Remember, it's the little things.
There you go.